So, I found out something pretty wild today. More financial reps get their careers just completely destroyed, like fined, fired, permanently barred from the industry for trying to give their friends a simple referral bonus than for, actually stealing from client accounts.
Yeah, it sounds completely counterintuitive when you first hear it, right? I mean, we're totally conditioned to think of regulatory enforcement as catching the Bernie Madoffs of the world.
Right, the evil masterminds.
Exactly, the people maliciously embezzling funds. But the reality of regulatory risk is, well, it's far more mundane, and honestly, it's way easier to stumble into by accident.
Which is terrifying.
Oh, it really is. Because the quickest way to end a career in finance isn't malice. It's just a fundamental misunderstanding of who is legally allowed to get paid for moving money.
Which, if you're prepping for your Series 82 exam, or frankly, if you're just operating in the private markets right now, is a pretty big deal.
Oh, absolutely. The rules governing how money moves, who gets a cut, and what paperwork is filed in the shadows of the private market, they are incredibly strict.
And that is exactly our mission today. We are taking a massive stack of sources like the FINRA rulebook, SEC interpretive releases, and your comprehensive Series 82 study notes, and we're going to untangle the exact mechanics of private placement filings.
And of course, the compensation traps that can just blow up a career overnight.
Exactly. But hey, before we get into the weeds of the regulatory framework, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel.
Oh, yeah. If you're staring down the barrel of the Series 82 exam, you definitely need to check them out.
Seriously. They've got a full course loaded with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams. And the best part is the exams are weighted just like the real thing.
Right, so you aren't wasting your time on like minor footnotes when you should be studying core concepts.
Yeah, exactly. So check them out at certfuel.com. Okay, so getting back to the rules, I feel like to really understand these FANRAI rules, we can't just read them off a page.
No, definitely not. The rulebook is incredibly dry. I mean, reading it straight through is basically the fastest way to forget how the mechanisms actually work in practice.
It's just endless acronym.
Right. And you got to remember, the regulators didn't write these rules in a vacuum. They wrote them in response to real people, constantly trying to find loopholes.
Yeah, people trying to bend the system. So to keep us grounded in reality today, we're going to use a recurring cast of characters to guide you, our listener, through these hypotheticals.
I love this approach. It makes it so much easier to visualize.
Right. Okay, so I want you to picture three specific people as we walk through these regulations. First up, we have Riley the rep.
Ah, Riley.
Yeah, Riley is a registered broker. He's energetic, he means well, but he is just constantly hovering right on the bleeding edge of non-compliance.
He's the guy sweating through his suit because he cares way more about closing the deal than reading the fine print of his compliance manual.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We all know O'Reilly.
Oh, yeah. And we actually need a broker like Riley for these scenarios because the exam questions are specifically designed to test the boundaries. Like, what can a broker actually get away with?
Right. If Riley always followed the rules perfectly, there'd be no exam to take.
Exactly.
Okay. So next we have Sam, the sponsor. Sam is an entrepreneur. He's the issuer of the securities.
So he's the guy building the business.
Yeah. Sam has big ideas. He's expanding his companies, and he is perpetually looking to raise capital to fund his operations.
And let me guess, Sam does not care about FINRA rules.
Sam absolutely does not care about FINRA rules
Right.
because he's not a broker. He just wants the cash to build his business.
Makes sense.
And finally, we have Ingrid the investor. Ingrid is the client holding the capital.
Someone with the checkbook.
Exactly. Now, depending on the scenario we're looking at, Ingrid's profile might shift a bit. Sometimes she's a massive institutional whale managing a sovereign wealth fund.
Right, a real heavy hitter.
Yeah, and sometimes she's just a wealthy tech founder looking for yield in the private markets. But the constant is that Ingrid always holds the purse strings.
Okay, so we've got Riley, Sam, and Ingrid. And the thing you really need to understand is that the entire regulatory burden we're discussing today drops squarely onto Riley's shoulders the absolute millisecond he attempts to connect Sam's securities with Ingrid's money.
The
The
millis.
millisecond. I mean, FINRA is obsessed with transparency in these private transactions, and they enforce that transparency through a very specific hidden paperwork clock.
Ooh, a hidden clock. Okay, let's get right into that clock and the core filing requirement. Because if I'm reading these FINRA notes correctly, the basic rule, this is under FINRA Rule 5123, seems to be that if Riley sells Sam's non-public offering and he's relying on a registration exemption to do it, his broker-dealer firm has to file the offering documents with FINRA.
Yep, That is the baseline requirement.
Okay, so we're talking about the private placement memorandum, the PPM, right?
Right. The PPM, the term sheets, the retail communications, basically anything that was used to pitch Ingrid on the deal. FINRA wants to see all of it.
Just to make sure they aren't, like, lying to her.
Pretty much. They want to review the disclosures, understand the use of proceeds, and really just ensure the broker-dealer is conducting proper due diligence before pitching this private stock to an investor.
Okay, but wait. If I'm Riley, and I'm looking for a loophole here, what if Riley and Sam decide to keep this incredibly quiet?
What do you mean?
Like, let's say they pitch Ingrid entirely on a handshake. No PPM was ever drafted. No term sheets were printed. Literally zero written materials were ever created or handed to Ingrid.
Oh, boy.
It was just, you know, a conversation over an expensive steak dinner and she wired the funds. Does Riley's firm still have an obligation to file something with FINRA if there's physically nothing to file?
That is a great question.
Right. So, listener, I want you to put yourself in Riley's shoes for a second. Take a beat and think about this. Your compliance officer asks for the documents to file and you say, hey, we didn't use any. Are you off the hook?
I can tell you right now, if you're assuming that a lack of documents equals a lack of filing obligations, you are falling into one of the most common traps in the industry.
Wait, really? So he's not off the hook?
Absolutely not. In that specific scenario, doing nothing is a massive regulatory violation. The firm must affirmatively notify FINRA that no documents were used.
Wait, hold on. They have to submit a formal filing just to announce that they have nothing to submit?
They do.
That sounds insane.
It sounds insane until you look at the underlying logic of the regulator. Then it actually makes perfect sense.
Okay, explain it to me.
Well, imagine you're sitting in FINRA's surveillance department, right? You see that Riley's firm just executed a massive private placement because obviously the money moved through the banking system.
Right. They see the funds clearing.
Exactly. But you haven't received any paperwork from Riley's firm. As a regulator, you're now facing a data gap.
A data gap.
Yeah. Does the absence of paperwork mean that no documents were ever created? Or does it mean that Riley's firm is just sloppy, they used a heavily misleading PPM, and they just forgot or intentionally neglected to file it?
Oh. So FINRA can't regulate based on assumptions.
Exactly.
They don't know if you're being secretive or just incompetent.
Precisely. So they demand negative confirmation.
Negative confirmation.
Yes. The firm has to log into the FINRA gateway system and explicitly, affirmatively state, we executed this private offering and no private placement memorandum or written materials were used.
Man, that reminds me of dealing with the IRS.
How so?
Well, it's like trying to deduct a business expense but having no receipt.
Yeah.
If you get audited, you can't just stare blankly at the auditor and hand them an empty folder, hoping they assume you lost the receipt. You have to affirmatively declare the nature of the expense and explain why the documentation doesn't exist. You can't just be silent. You have an affirmative duty to speak up.
That is a perfect analogy. And, you know, the Series 82 exam writers, they know that human nature operates on the assumption of no documents, no task.
Right. If my desk is clear, I'm done working.
Exactly. So they will construct these elaborate scenarios where Sam and Riley conduct a completely paperless transaction, and then they'll offer you a multiple choice answer that says no filing is required because no written offering documents were utilized.
And it's a trap.
It is a giant trap. You must affirmatively file the notice of no documents.
Okay, got it. So let's talk about the timeline for this filing, because the study notes place a huge emphasis on when this hidden clock actually starts ticking.
Oh, the clock is everything.
So the rule states that this filing is due within 15 calendar days of the date of first sale.
That phrase right there, date of first sale, is the absolute fulcrum of the entire rule.
Okay, let's test this then. Listener, follow along with this timeline. Let's say on January 1st, Sam, the sponsor, finishes drafting a gorgeous 100-page PPM.
Okay, January 1st.
On February 1st, Riley officially launches the offering and starts calling clients.
February 1st, marketing begins.
Right. Then, on March 1st, Riley has dinner with Ingrid, pitches her the deal, and physically hands her that PPM.
The pitch happens on March 1st.
Yes. Finally, on April 1st, Ingrid signs the subscription agreement and wires the funds, making her the very first investor in the fund.
Okay.
So, listener, when does the 15-day clock start? Does it start when the document is made, when the marketing starts, when Ingrid gets the pitch, or when she signs?
The clock starts on April 1st.
But wait, the PPM was finalized 3 months prior? FINRA could have been reviewing it that whole time.
You'd think so, right? But regulators do not care when the marketing started.
Really?
Really, and they do not care when the documents were finalized. FENRA's jurisdiction over this specific filing triggers on the execution of the transaction.
Wow, okay.
The exact moment Ingrid's signature goes on the subscription agreement and the funds are committed, that is the first sale.
So that's day zero.
That is your day zero. The moment that first transaction becomes a reality, the 15-day clock drops. Everything leading up to that point is just considered preliminary marketing.
Okay, so on the exam, if they give me a huge paragraph outlining the date the board approved the offering, the date the marketing materials were printed, the date the broker first shook the client's hand, I should just ignore all of that noise.
It is entirely noise. It's specifically designed to test your confidence in the rule.
So I just scan the paragraph exclusively for the moment money and commitments change hands.
Exactly. Look for the money.
Awesome. And the rule says 15 calendar days. I want to emphasize that word calendar because this isn't 15 business days, right?
Oh, that distinction is critical. Calendar days mean the clock does not stop for weekends. It does not stop for federal holidays.
It doesn't stop because your compliance officer is in Cancun.
It definitely doesn't stop for that. If day 15 happens to fall on Thanksgiving, your filing was due on Thanksgiving. The system is entirely electronic. FENRA expects you to manage your calendar accordingly.
That is brutal. Okay, so let's talk about confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I am Sam, the sponsor, I am probably terrified of Riley sending my private financial projections to a government regulator.
Yeah, issuers hate this part.
Right, because does filing this private placement notice mean that Sam's closely guarded corporate secrets, his cap table, all the proprietary technology details embedded in the PPM, does all that suddenly become public record searchable on the internet?
That is a very valid concern for issuers, but the answer is a hard no.
Okay, phew.
FENRA treats every single document filed under Rule 5123 as strictly confidential. This is not like a public IPO prospectus that gets blasted out on the SEC's EDGAR database for the entire world to read.
So FENRA is just keeping it in-house.
Exactly. They are requesting these documents for internal regulatory surveillance. They're looking to see if Riley's broker-dealer fulfilled its suitability and disclosure obligations. They are not acting as a public library for Sam's trade secrets.
But I assume a clever exam question might try to conflate those two things.
Without doubt.
Like they might say, because the information is strictly confidential, the firm can request a 30-day extension to ensure secure transmission.
And they will absolutely try to offer you a way out like that. But confidentiality has zero bearing on the deadline.
None at all.
None. The documents are confidential, yes, but they are still unequivocally due on day 15. No extensions for paranoia.
Man, they are strict. Okay, this actually brings up something that has been driving me crazy as I review these study materials.
What's that?
There are just so many different filings for what appears to be the exact same private offering. It feels like the financial industry intentionally created a multiverse of overlapping paperwork just to confuse people.
I mean, it certainly feels that way when you're studying it.
Like, why do we have the FENRA private placement notice, the SEC Form D, and the FENRA member private offering rule? How does a rep keep these straight?
It can definitely feel like regulatory overlap, but each of those filings serves a distinct purpose. It goes to a different regulator, and it's triggered by different entities.
Okay.
And honestly, the easiest way to lose points on the Series 82 is to mix up whose responsibility it is to file what. So let's do a direct side-by-side comparison.
Yes, please. Let's start with the standard FENRA notice we've been discussing versus the SEC Form D.
Okay, the division of labor here is based on the entity.
The entity.
Yeah. Riley's firm, the registered broker-dealer, is the one regulated by FENRA. Therefore, the broker-dealer files the INRA private placement notice under Rule 5123.
Okay, so Riley's boss handles FENRA.
Exactly. Sam, the sponsor, however, is the issuer of the securities. If Sam is relying on Regulation D to avoid registering his securities publicly, Sam has an obligation to the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Ah, the SEC.
Right, so Sam must file a Form D with the SEC.
Got it. Two different filings. Going to two different regulatory bodies, filed by two completely different entities.
And here is the trap.
Lay it on me.
Filing one does not satisfy the obligation for the other.
Wait, really?
Really? So if Riley's compliance department is highly efficient and files their FENRA notice on day two, Sam cannot look at that and say, great, the government knows about the deal. I don't need to file Form D.
Sam still has to do his own homework.
Sam still has to file his Form D. Furthermore, FENRA explicitly states that a broker-dealer cannot just send a copy of the SEC Form D to FENRA and call it a day.
They want the real stuff.
Yes. Fenero wants the actual offering documents, not just the SEC's high-level summary form.
Okay, so let's put you, the listener, in a scenario to test this mechanic. We know that both of these filings, the Fenero notice and the SEC Form D, are triggered by the exact same event.
Right.
Right.
First sale.
Right. They are both due within 15 calendar days of the date of first sale. Now imagine it is day 15, the absolute deadline.
Okay.
But day 15 happens to fall on a Sunday.
Oh, this is a classic.
So listener, take a second. Does Riley get to roll his FINRA deadline to Monday? Does Sam get to roll his SEC Form D deadline to Monday? Think about the distinction between the two regulators.
Give him a beat.
Okay. So, if you guess that both of them roll over, you fell for it.
Hook, line, and sinker.
The answer is no. Only the SEC Form D deadline rolls off a weekend or a federal holiday to the next business day.
The SEC rules explicitly allow for that grace period. So if your Form D is due on a Sunday, you can file it on Monday without penalty.
What FINRA?
But as we established earlier, FINRA's calendar day count is merciless. If Riley's FINRA deadline hits on a Sunday, it is due on Sunday because the electronic gateway is open 24/7.
That is such a crucial distinction. It really highlights why you have to read the first sentence of an exam question so carefully.
Extremely carefully. If the question asks about the broker-dealer's filing obligation, you apply the strict FINRA weekend rule. If it asks about the issuer's obligation, you apply the SEC rollover rule.
Okay, let's shift to the second major comparison that causes confusion. The standard FINRA private placement notice, Rule 5123, versus the member private offering rule, which is FINRA Rule 5122.
Okay, let's break it down.
Both of these are FINRA rules, so they apply to the broker-dealer. Why are there two separate rules for private placements within the same rule book?
It all comes down to who is issuing the securities and the inherent conflicts of interest involved.
Conflicts of interest.
Yeah. So in our standard scenario, Sam the sponsor is an unrelated third party, right?
Right. He's just some guy.
He runs a logistics company or a software startup, whatever. Riley's firm is just acting as the middleman, selling Sam's stock to Ingrid.
Collecting the money.
Exactly. When you sell an unrelated issuer's securities, you use the standard rule 5123 notice.
Okay. But what if Sam doesn't exist?
What do you mean?
Like, what if Riley's own broker-dealer firm is the one issuing the securities? Let's say Riley's firm wants to expand, they need capital, and they decide to sell equity in their own broker-dealer to private investors.
Oh, well, that completely rewrites the regulatory equation.
Does it?
Yes. If the member firm itself, or a control entity of the firm, is the issuer of the securities, then the member private offering rule 5122 applies instead.
Wait, let's define control entity before we move on. What does FINRA consider a control entity?
It's a broad net, actually. A control entity is any entity that controls the broker-dealer, is under common control with the broker-dealer, or is controlled by the broker-dealer or its associated persons.
That is a mouthful. Give me numbers.
Basically, if you own 25% or more of the voting securities or have the right to 25% or more of the distributable profits, FINRA views that as control.
Okay, so if Riley's firm has a parent holding company, and that parent company is issuing the stock, it still falls under the member private offering rule.
Exactly. It's all under Rule 5122.
But why does FINRA view this so differently? I mean, why does a broker-dealer selling its own stock trigger a completely different rule with heavier requirements?
Because the conflict of interest is astronomical.
Is it really that bad?
Oh, absolutely. Look, FINRA's primary mandate is to protect investors from predatory broker behavior.
Right.
When a broker is selling an unrelated third-party stock, they are earning a commission, sure, but they still have an objective duty to ensure the investment is suitable.
They can look at it somewhat neutrally.
Exactly. However, when a broker is calling a client and saying, hey, you should invest your life savings directly into my employer.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Right. The objectivity completely vanishes. The broker-dealer might be desperate for capital, and they might use their sales force to aggressively push their own potentially toxic debt or equity onto unsuspecting retail clients.
Wow. Yeah, that is a massive conflict. So FINRA demands a higher level of scrutiny.
Much higher. Under the member private offering rule, the disclosures provided to the investor must be incredibly detailed. The firm must explicitly detail the intended use of the offering proceeds, and they generally have to put the raised funds into a separate escrow account until a minimum contingency is met.
An escrow account?
Yeah. FINRA is essentially saying, if you want to raise money for yourselves, you have to prove to us that you aren't just using client funds as a slush fund to pay your own massive executive bonuses.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so the standard notice is for selling someone else's equity, and the member private offering rule is for selling your own.
Spot on.
But a firm would never file the exact same offering under both rules, correct?
Correct. FINRA doesn't want duplicate paperwork. The rules explicitly state that if an offering is filed under the member private offering rule, it is automatically exempt from the standard rule 5123 filing requirement.
One satisfies the other.
Exactly.
Which provides a perfect transition into our next major topic, finding exemptions.
Ah, everyone's favorite loophole.
Right. Because filing these notices is a massive administrative burden. It requires legal review, compliance sign-offs, and it slows down the velocity of capital.
It really does.
So if the regulatory burden is so heavy, how do massive Wall Street institutions get billion-dollar deals done without constantly getting bogged down in these 15-day filing windows? There must be a carve-out for the big players.
There is. FINRA understands that not every transaction requires their protective oversight. They have carved out 14 specific categories of private placements that are completely exempt from the Rule 5123 filing requirement.
14 categories.
Yes. And if Riley's deal fits into one of these 14 buckets, he doesn't have to file the PPM. He doesn't have to notify FINRA. The 15-day clock never even starts.
Okay, but 14 categories is a massive list to memorize for an exam.
Yeah.
Can we group them logically to understand why FINRA allows these exemptions?
Absolutely. The 14 exemptions generally fall into three philosophical buckets.
Okay, hit me with bucket one.
The first bucket is offerings sold solely to highly sophisticated buyers who don't need FINRA to hold their hand.
Makes sense. Bucket two.
The second bucket is offerings that are already heavily regulated by another framework, so FINRA doesn't need to duplicate the effort.
Got it. And the third?
And the third bucket, as we just discussed, is offerings the member firm already filed with FINRA under a different, stricter rule, like the member private offering rule.
Awesome. Let's dive deep into that first bucket, because the institutional buyer exemption is the one that is guaranteed to show up on the Series 82 exam.
Oh, 100%. It's always there.
So who exactly qualifies as a sophisticated buyer under this rule?
This category covers sales made to qualified institutional buyers, commonly known as QIBs. It also covers sales to registered investment companies, banks, and very specific, massive accredited investors.
Massive accredited investors. Like who?
Like entities or trusts that hold over $5 million in total assets.
Okay, let's pause and define a QIB, because the exam won't just let you slide by with the acronym. What separates a QIB from a regular wealthy person?
Yeah.
Like, if Ingrid the investor is super rich, is she a QIB?
No, she is not. A qualified institutional buyer is an entity, not an individual human being, but an entity.
Oh, so no humans allowed.
Exactly. It's an entity that owns and invests on a discretionary basis at least $100 million in securities of issuers that are not affiliated with the entity.
$100 million?
Yeah, we are talking about massive insurance companies, massive employee benefit plans, or trust funds with extraordinary scale.
So they have deep, deep pockets.
Right. And FINRA looks at a QIB and says, these entities have armies of corporate lawyers and analysts. They can conduct their own due diligence on Sam's private placement. They don't need a FINRA examiner checking the broker's paperwork to protect them.
That makes logical sense. Mm. But here is the trap. The exam gotcha.
Oh, this is a good one.
The rule explicitly states that the exemption applies if the offering is sold solely to these specific types of institutional buyers.
That single word, solely, is the most dangerous word in the entire FINRA rulebook regarding exemptions.
Let me paint a very specific scenario for you, the listener, and I want you to evaluate how this rule applies.
Let's hear it.
So Riley is managing a massive capital raise for Sam's new artificial intelligence startup. The deal size is $500 million.
Huge deal.
Right. And Riley sells 499.5 million of this offering to 50 different qualified institutional buyers. Sovereign wealth funds, major banks, the biggest players on Wall Street. The deal is almost entirely institutional.
It's almost entirely.
But Riley has a client named Ingrid. And we know Ingrid is a brilliant tech founder. She recently sold a small app for a couple of $1 million, so she is wealthy. But she does not meet the strict $5 million asset test required to be an institutional entity under this specific rule. Plus, she's a human, not an entity.
Right. She's just a rich individual.
Right. So Riley wants to do her a favor because they go way back. So he lets her invest $500,000 into the deal.
A tiny drop in the bucket.
Exactly. So, listener, think about this. Does Riley still get to claim the institutional exemption for the $499.5 million portion of the offering and perhaps just file some limited paperwork for Ingrid's fraction? If you are a compliance officer reviewing this trade, what is your ruling?
Give him a second to think.
What's the call?
Well, the compliance officer is going to have a heart attack.
Why? What is the ruling?
The ruling is that the entire exemption is instantly destroyed.
The whole thing?
The whole thing. FINRA does not allow for fractional exemptions. Solely means all or nothing.
Wow.
By allowing one single non-qualifying investor into a $500 million deal, Riley has contaminated the entire institutional pool. Because Ingrid bought in, the offering was not sold solely to institutional buyers.
Ingrid just blew up the whole exemption.
She really did. Riley now has an affirmative obligation to file the PPM, the term sheets, and all written materials for the entire $500 million offering within 15 days.
That is insane, but it highlights how incredibly careful a broker has to be with the cap table.
Oh, absolutely. If you are relying on an exemption based on the nature of the purchaser, you must verify the legal status of every single purchaser without exception.
And if we connect this back to our timeline rule from earlier, it creates a terrifying scenario.
Oh, the timing on this is brutal.
Right. Let's say Riley sold to those 50 QIBs over the course of 3 months. Because he thought the deal was exempt, he wasn't tracking any FANFRA 15-day clocks.
He thinks he's in the clear.
Then, on the very last day of the raise, Ingrid's trade closes. Ingrid's participation retroactively breaks the exemption for the entire offering.
Exactly. The moment her funds clear, she becomes the trigger. The 15-day clock to file the paperwork for the entire multi-month $500 million deal drops right then and there.
And if the firm doesn't realize this,
if they don't catch it, they will blow right past the deadline and get fined.
That is exactly the kind of chain reaction scenario the exam will test you on.
Okay, let's briefly look at the second bucket of categorical exemptions, things that are already highly regulated elsewhere. What falls into this group?
Standardized options are a great example. If you are trading listed options, the Options Clearing Corporation and the exchanges already have a massive overlapping regulatory framework in place.
So FINRA just sips back. Yeah, FINRA doesn't need a separate private placement notice for that. Mm-hmm. Variable contracts are another one, like variable annuities or variable life insurance. They're heavily regulated by state insurance commissioners and the SEC. FINRA exempts them.
What about foreign stuff?
Offerings made under Regulation S, which govern offshore sales to non-US persons, are exempt because they fall outside the primary domestic jurisdiction.
Okay, the study notes also mention a specific exemption for debt. Short-term institutional debt.
Yes. But the exam loves to test the highly specific, rigid parameters of this debt exemption.
What are the parameters?
To qualify, it must be short-term commercial paper that is either exempt under the Securities Act itself or privately placed debt that meets two very strict non-negotiable criteria.
Okay, criteria one.
First, the debt must have a maturity of 397 days or less.
And criteria two.
And second, it must be issued in minimum denominations of $150,000.
Wait, let me stop you right there. 397 days.
No, it sounds weird.
That is such a bizarrely specific number. It's a year and, like, roughly a month. Why wouldn't regulators just say 1 year or 365 days? What is the underlying logic behind 397 days?
It seems totally random, but it's actually based on the realities of corporate auditing.
Auditing.
Regulators want this debt to be truly short-term, meaning the company will have to pay it back or refinance it relatively quickly. But if you restrict it to exactly 365 days, it creates a nightmare for a company trying to align their debt maturity with their annual financial audit cycle.
Oh, because audits take time.
Exactly. An annual audit takes time to complete and publish. By giving them 397 days, roughly 13 months, regulators allow a company to issue debt, complete a full one-year operating cycle, finish their annual audit, present those audited financials to the market.
And then use that fresh data to roll the debt over or pay it off.
You got it. It provides a necessary administrative grace period without allowing the debt to become a long-term unmonitored obligation.
That is fascinating. So the 397 days accommodates the audit cycle. And what about the second criteria, the $150,000 minimum denomination?
That is a pure gatekeeping mechanism.
Keep the little guys out.
Precisely. If a company could issue short-term exempt debt in $1,000 increments, Riley could sell it to regular retail investors who have no idea how to evaluate commercial paper risks.
So they forced the price up.
By forcing the minimum purchase to be $150,000, Fenaraa ensures that only investors with significant capital, who presumably have the sophistication to understand the risks, are buying this unregistered debt.
So it's a two-pronged test. Let's run a scenario. If Sam issues debt that matures in 400 days, even if the denomination is $1 million.
It is not exempt. It breaches the 397-day limit. The firm must file the notice.
Okay. And if Sam issues debt maturing in 300 days, but he sells it in $50,000 chunks.
Also not exempt. It fails the denomination test. Both prongs must be met simultaneously.
Okay. But what if Riley is working on a deal that is entirely unique? Let's say it's a bespoke joint venture. It doesn't fit the institutional exemption because there are a few retail folks involved.
Okay.
It's not short-term debt. It's not a variable annuity. It fits exactly zero of the 14 automatic categories. Is there any regulatory hope for him to avoid the filing, or is he doomed to submit the paperwork?
Well, there is one final avenue, but it is definitely not a guarantee. It's called the individualized exemption.
Separate
from the 14 automatic categories, Fenaraa allows a member firm to apply directly to the regulator for a case-by-case exemption.
Oh, so Riley can just shoot a quick email to his Fenaraa examiner, explain the situation, and ask for a waiver.
Absolutely not, and that is a massive exam trap.
Damn.
The individualized exemption is never automatic, and it cannot be requested informally. The applicant must show good cause in a highly formal written application process.
So it's a whole legal process.
Oh, yeah. Fenaraa subjects these requests to a rigorous exemptive relief review. They will scrutinize the deal structure, the investor protections in place, and the reason why the standard filing would be unnecessarily burdensome.
And they could just say no.
They might grant the exemption, but they are equally likely to deny it and force the filing.
Who actually holds the authority to make this request?
Yeah.
If Riley is the one managing the deal, does he submit the application?
This is a fantastic nuance that tests your understanding of the regulatory hierarchy. An associated person, a registered representative like Riley, cannot apply for this exemption on their own behalf.
Really? Even if it's his deal?
Even if it's his deal.
Yeah.
Riley can be listed as the primary contact person on the application to answer questions, but the member firm itself must be the official applicant.
That makes total sense, because Fenaraa's relationship is primarily with the broker-dealer firm, not the individual rep.
Exactly. The firm is responsible for supervising Riley, so the firm has to put its name on the line to request the favor.
Riley cannot go rogue and ask Fenaraa for a regulatory pass without his compliance department sponsoring the request.
You got it.
Okay, we have survived the intricacies of the filing paperwork and the exemptions. We understand the clock, the overlapping jurisdictions, and the categorical carve-outs.
Which is huge. That's a lot of material.
It is. But now we are shifting gears into something that is even more heavily scrutinized and, honestly, a lot more dramatic in how it destroys careers.
Oh, yeah. This is the scary part.
We are moving into prohibited compensation, specifically the finder's fee trap.
If the filing rules are where firms get fined, the compensation rules are where individuals get barred from the industry.
The core concept here revolves around transaction-based compensation. The absolute baseline rule is that you cannot pay transaction-based compensation to an unregistered person.
And in the industry, we often call these unregistered people introducers or finders.
Let's set the stage with a very realistic scenario. Riley the rep is desperate to find new, wealthy investors for Sam's private placement. Riley is at his local country club playing a round of golf, and he meets a guy named Gary.
Gary the golfer.
Yes, Gary the golfer. Gary is an incredibly well-connected local businessman. But Gary has never taken a securities exam in his life. He is not a registered broker-dealer.
Okay.
Gary says to Riley, listen, I know this wildly wealthy woman named Ingrid. She is looking for exactly the kind of private deals you are selling. I can make the introduction, but obviously I want a little piece of the action if she actually invests.
Standard business proposition.
Right. Which, if you think about it, sounds completely normal in almost any other sector of the economy.
Absolutely.
If I introduce a buyer to a real estate agent, I might get a referral fee. If I refer a client to a software vendor, I get a commission kickback. Affiliate marketing runs the entire internet.
It does.
But in securities, this normal business behavior is a fatal error.
It is strictly, unequivocally prohibited. Under Fenaraa rules, no member firm or associated person may, directly or indirectly, pay any compensation, commissions, concessions, or fees to anyone who is not registered as a broker-dealer if that payment is tied to bringing in securities business.
Let me push back on this, because brokers are clever. What if Riley realizes he can't pay Gary a percentage commission, so he tries to rebrand the payment?
Oh, they try this all the time.
Like, what if Riley says, Gary, I know paying you a commission is illegal, but you provided valuable consulting services to me on this golf course. I am going to pay you a $10,000 flat marketing allowance out of my own pocket. Does that bypass the rule?
This brings us to the cornerstone of financial regulation, substance over label.
Substance over label.
Yes. Regulators are not blind, and they do not care what creative title you put on the invoice.
It is like trying to deduct a family vacation to Disney World as a corporate board meeting on your taxes, just because you talked about the business for 5 minutes while writing the teacups.
That is exactly what it's like.
The IRS is going to look at the receipts, see the Mickey Mouse ears, and determine the true substance of the trip was a vacation, regardless of what you wrote on the expense report. FinArray operates the exact same way.
That is a perfect parallel. FinArray looks at the underlying mechanics of the payment. If Gary gets paid because Ingrid invested, or if the payment is in any way contingent on the successful closing of a securities transaction, then it is transaction-based compensation.
It doesn't matter what you call it.
It does not matter if Riley calls it a marketing allowance, a consulting fee, or a referral bonus. By receiving money tied to a securities transaction, Gary is acting as an unregistered broker. And by paying him, Riley is facilitating an illegal unregistered securities business.
So relabeling the kickback does not save you. The substance of the activity dictates the application of the rule. Now, it's not just that Riley is forbidden from doing this. The broker-dealer firm itself has an affirmative burden to ensure these illegal payments aren't happening behind the scenes.
Right. Absolutely. The firm cannot just institute a policy, cross its fingers, and hope Riley isn't paying off his country club buddies.
They have to actively police it.
Yes. The supplementary material under this FinR&R rule places a strict four-step affirmative burden on the member firm before any non-standard payment can go out the door.
Walk me through those four steps. If I am the compliance officer, what exactly do I have to do?
First, the firm must affirmatively determine that the proposed activities do not require the recipient to register as a broker-dealer. You have to analyze what Gary actually did.
Okay, determine. What's step two?
Second, the firm must be able to reasonably support that determination with regulatory precedent.
Support.
Step three.
Third, the firm must maintain written records reflecting exactly how they arrived at that conclusion.
Maintain records. And the final step.
And fourth, if these payments to Gary are ongoing, the firm must review the arrangement periodically to ensure his role hasn't morphed into unregistered selling.
So determine, support, maintain records, review.
I want to zoom in on that second step. Reasonably support. How does a firm legally prove a negative? How do they prove that Gary doesn't need to be registered?
FinR&R provides guidance on how a firm can derive this reasonable support. They offer three primary examples.
What are they?
First, a firm can rely on previously published releases or no action letters from the SEC that match the exact facts of their situation.
Okay.
Alternatively, if the situation is novel, they can proactively petition the SEC staff for a brand new no action letter.
Ask for permission, basically.
Right. Or third, they can obtain a formal legal opinion from an independent, reputable U.S. licensed attorney who specializes in federal securities law.
Okay, listener, pay very close attention right now because this is a classic exam trick.
Oh, they love this one.
The exam will list those three methods, SEC releases, no action letters, and independent legal opinions. Then it will present a scenario and state, in order to pay an unregistered consultant, the member firm must obtain an independent legal opinion to satisfy its supervisory burden.
Yep, that's exactly how they phrase it.
True or false? Does the firm legally have to hire an outside lawyer to write an opinion?
If you say true, you lose the point. The answer is false.
But why? An independent legal opinion sounds like the gold standard of support.
It is excellent support, but the rule explicitly states that firms can derive support, among other things, by using those methods. Those three options are provided as safe, illustrative examples of what constitutes reasonable support.
So just suggestions.
Exactly. They are not a mandatory checklist, and none of them are individually required by law. A firm could potentially support its determination using internal compliance analysis based on well-established case law.
So as long as it's reasonable.
The only thing the rule strictly requires is that the determination is, in fact, reasonable under the circumstances. The exam will try to force you into choosing one specific method as a rigid legal requirement.
Good to know. Okay, so we've established that Riley absolutely cannot pay Gary for an introduction, and his firm has to police him heavily to prevent it. But is there literally any scenario where a finder's fee is actually legal? Is there any exception to this blanket prohibition?
There is one very narrow, highly specific exception, and it entirely revolves around international borders.
Oh.
It is the foreign finder exception.
The double foreign rule.
Yes. A member firm is permitted to pay a non-registered foreign finder transaction-related compensation for customer business that the finder directs to the firm. But the geographic conditions are incredibly rigid.
Let's test the listener on this geographic boundary.
Yeah.
Let's say Riley hires a finder who is based in London.
Oh, London finder.
This finder is a UK citizen, operates entirely in Europe, and is not registered with the SEC or FINRA. The London finder introduces Riley to a wildly wealthy oil executive. The executive is an American citizen living in Texas.
American client.
Can Riley pay the London finder a transaction-based fee for bringing in the Texas executive? Evaluate the geography, listener.
This is exactly the scenario the exam will use to test your understanding of the boundary.
If you think it's allowed because the finder is foreign, you are wrong. The answer is no. Riley cannot pay the fee.
The reason is that the exception demands a double foreign relationship.
Double foreign.
Yes. The finder must be a foreign national or foreign entity. Indeed, the customer they are bringing in must also be a foreign national or a foreign entity domiciled abroad.
Let's break down the logic of why the regulators demand both sides be foreign. Why does FINRA care if a UK finder brings in an American client?
Because FINRA and the SEC have a statutory mandate to protect U.S. investors.
Right.
If an unregistered person who is not bound by U.S. suitability rules, who hasn't passed U.S. licensing exams, and who is outside the jurisdictional reach of U.S. regulators is aggressively pitching securities to an American citizen in Texas, the SEC views that as a massive risk.
Because they can't touch the guy in London.
Exactly. The unregistered finder might be lying about the investment just to earn the commission, and the U.S. regulators would have no way to punish them.
But what if it's foreign on both sides?
If a UK finder is pitching a deal to a UK investor, the primary mandate of protecting U.S. citizens is not triggered. The transaction is essentially happening between two foreign nationals, so U.S. regulators provide a narrow safe harbor for the U.S. broker to pay the finder.
So a foreign finder bringing in a U.S. customer fails. What about the reverse? What if Gary, the U.S. country club guy, brings in a client from France?
Also fails. Gary is a U.S. person operating in the U.S. He must be registered to receive transaction-based compensation. It must be foreign on both sides of the equation, double foreign.
And what about the security itself? Does the London investor have to be buying foreign stock for this to work?
No, that is an important distinction. The foreign customer can transact in either foreign or U.S. securities through the U.S. broker-dealer. The exception turns entirely on the citizenship and domicile of the humans and entities involved, not on the nationality of the security being purchased.
Okay, so let's say we have a London finder bringing in a London investor. We pass the double foreign test. Can Riley just wire the London finder his commission in Bitcoin and call it a day?
Absolutely not. Passing the geographic test just opens the door to a massive pile of required paperwork.
Of course it does.
The compliance burden on the firm is severe.
What does the firm have to do before they can send that payment?
First, the firm has to assure itself that the foreign finder isn't subject to statutory disqualification in the U.S., meaning they haven't been banned by the SEC for previous fraud, and that paying them doesn't violate the laws of their home country.
Which means the U.S. firm essentially has to understand U.K. financial regulations before paying a U.K. finder.
Correct. Second, the firm must provide the foreign customer with a descriptive document detailing the exact compensation arrangement with the finder. The customer has to know their introducer is getting paid.
Okay, transparency.
Third, the customer must provide written acknowledgement of that disclosure. The investor has to sign a document saying, yes, I understand my introducer is getting a cut of my investment.
And the firm has to keep that signed acknowledgement in their files for FINRA to inspect.
Yes, but the transparency requirements don't stop there.
There's more.
Oh, yeah. The firm must maintain detailed records of the actual payments on its own books, and this is the most critical operational hurdle. The firm must ensure that every single trade confirmation sent to that foreign customer explicitly discloses that a finder's fee is being paid out of the transaction.
Transparency all the way down to the individual trade ticket.
Exactly. The message from FINRA is clear. We will let you do this, but we are going to make it incredibly administratively painful so you don't abuse it.
Mm. Okay, before we move to the final recap, I want to circle back to Sam the sponsor and address a topic that requires a deep dive because it constantly trips people up on the exam.
Okay, let's hear it.
We just established that Riley absolutely cannot pay Gary, an outside finder, unless Gary meets that strict double foreign rule. But what if the person helping sell the securities isn't an outsider? What if Sam the sponsor has a vice president of operations, and that VP is out there pitching the private placement to institutional investors alongside Riley?
Ah, the insider.
Is that VP acting as an illegal unregistered broker?
This is perhaps the most important direct comparison you must master for this section of the Series 82, because the rules seem contradictory until you understand the underlying legal mechanics.
Okay. Untangle it for me.
Sam as VP falls under a highly specific SEC rule known as the Associated Person Safe Harbor, specifically Rule 3A41.
Let's unpack the logic of this safe harbor. Why would the SEC allow Sam's VP to sell stock without a license, but threaten to end Riley's career if he pays Gary to do the same thing?
It comes down to the fundamental definition of a broker. A broker is someone who is engaged in the business of effecting transactions and securities for the account of others.
Right.
Gary is an outsider. He has no connection to Sam's company. He is just looking for a toll booth. He wants to leverage his Rolodex to make money off other people's transactions.
He's just a middleman.
Exactly. And the SEC says, if you want to do that, you must register as a broker-dealer and submit to our oversight.
But the VP is different.
The VP is fundamentally different. The VP is an insider. They are a direct employee, officer, or director of the company that is actually issuing the securities.
So they're part of the company.
When the VP is out there pitching the stock, they are essentially the company acting on its own behalf. The law recognizes that a corporate entity cannot speak except through its human employees.
Oh, that makes sense.
Therefore, the SEC provides a narrow safe harbor that says an issuer's own employees can help sell the issuer's securities without registering as brokers, provided they meet three incredibly strict conditions.
Let's go through those three conditions because this is highly testable.
Yeah.
If I am Sam's VP, what rules do I have to follow to stay inside the safe harbor?
The first condition is the most restrictive. The VP cannot receive any transaction-based compensation.
None at all.
None. They cannot receive commissions, bonuses, or any variable pay that is tied to the success of the capital raise.
Wait, so if Sam says, hey, VP, if you help me raise this $10 million, I'll give you a 2% bonus, the VP instantly loses the safe harbor.
Instantly. The moment their compensation is tied to the sale of securities, they are acting as a broker. The VP must be paid their standard, regular salary, regardless of whether the offering succeeds or fails.
Okay, what is the second condition?
The VP cannot have been registered as a broker-dealer or an associated person of a broker-dealer within the preceding 12 months.
A cooling-off period.
Yeah.
Why does the SEC care about their employment history?
The SEC wants to prevent companies from temporarily hiring a bunch of aggressive Wall Street brokers, calling them internal executives for 3 months just to run a massive unregulated boiler room sales operation and then firing them when the capital raise is done.
Oh, wow. That is a brilliant anti-loophole mechanism.
It really is. The 12-month cooling off period ensures the person is a genuine corporate employee, not a hired gun in disguise.
And the third condition.
The VP must have substantial duties for the issuer other than selling securities, both during and after the offering.
So the VP actually has to do the job of a VP of operations.
Exactly. They have to manage logistics, oversee staff, run the supply chain. They cannot just sit in a room making cold calls to investors all day.
If their primary function is selling the stock,
then they are a broker. If their primary function is running the company and they just happen to be assisting with a strategic capital raise on the side, they fit within the safe harbor.
So to summarize the comparison, Gary the golfer is an outsider seeking a commission. That is strictly prohibited.
Right.
Sam's VP is an insider, paid a flat salary, doing a real corporate job who hasn't been a broker recently. That is permitted under the safe harbor.
Exactly. Do not mix up the issuer's insider safe harbor, which excuses an insider from registering, with the outside finder ban, which prohibits paying an outsider.
If you can clearly articulate the difference between those two scenarios, you will easily navigate the most difficult compensation questions on the exam.
100%.
Okay. We have covered a massive expanse of regulatory ground today. We have dissected the filings, the jurisdictions, the exemptions, and the compensation traps. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute top testable takeaways from this deep dive so they are fresh in your mind.
Let's do it. Number one, the private placement notice filing deadline is 15 calendar days from the date of first sale. It is triggered by the moment funds and commitments change hands, not the date the PPM is finalized. And the calendar count is merciless. It includes weekends and holidays.
Number two, you must affirmatively notify FINRA even if zero documents exist. Remember the IRS audit analogy. You cannot hand the regulator an empty folder without explicitly speaking up to declare that no written materials were used.
Number three, if you are comparing filing timelines, always remember that the SEC Form D deadline provides a grace period. It rolls off a weekend or federal holiday to the next business day. FINRA's 15-day deadline does not.
Number four, for the institutional buyer exemption, remember Ingrid, the tech founder who blew up the deal? The word solely means exactly that. One single non-qualifying buyer ruins the entire exemption for everyone. It is an all-or-nothing proposition.
Number five, finder's fees are evaluated on substance, not the label you stick on the invoice. A family vacation called a board meeting is still a vacation. A commission disguised as a marketing allowance is still prohibited transaction-based compensation.
And number six, the foreign finder exception requires a strict double foreign relationship. It only works if you have a foreign finder and a foreign customer. U.S. involvement on either side of the transaction destroys the exception.
Now, before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought.
Ooh, what is it?
Something to chew on that goes a bit beyond the memorization of the exam material and looks at the reality of the financial system we just described. Think about this. FINRA requires all of these private placement filings. They demand the PPMs, the term sheets, the detailed retail communications, the intricate cap tables. But as we discussed, they treat every single one of these filings as strictly internally confidential.
Which means the public never sees them.
Exactly. That means FINRA is sitting on a massive, hidden, centralized database of exactly how private, unregistered money moves in this country.
Oh, wow.
They know the exact terms being offered in the shadows. They know which sponsors are aggressively raising debt. They know exactly what the massive institutional whales and the ultra-wealthy individuals are buying before those trends ever hit the public markets.
That's incredible.
If we could somehow see what FINRA sees in those confidential files, if we can query that database, what completely invisible market trends do you think we would discover about how the most powerful players are truly positioning their money right now?
Wow. That is mind-blowing when you frame it that way. It's like FINRA has the master blueprint to an entirely invisible financial skyscraper, and the rest of us are just walking around on the street level trying to guess how tall the building is based on the shadows it casts.
The entire structure of the private market is supported by this confidential paperwork. Understanding how that paperwork flows is the key to understanding the system.
Well, now you know exactly how to file that paperwork. You know when the hidden clock starts ticking. You know why the regulators demand it. And you know exactly who you absolutely cannot pay to help you build the deal.
You understand the why behind the what.
You've got this exam in the bag. Keep studying. Keep Riley, Sam, and Ingrid in your head as you run through practice questions. And remember the rules of the invisible structure. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you on the next one.